You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Hey everybody, welcome to this week's episode of Monster Attack, the podcast dedicated to old monster movies. Well, we're back from a well-deserved two-week vacation. We appreciate your indulgence with us as we gave the shows a pass for just a couple of weeks while I was out of town. But I'll tell you what, folks, first time we've taken a vacation on Monster Attack since we started. So it felt pretty good. As I went back to the old hometown and stayed up at the lake, up in the Finger Lakes in New York, revisited some of the places where I used to watch monster movies, and even tried to track down Baron Damon, who I found out was still alive. But unfortunately, the trip was too short for me to find Mike Price, a.k.a. Baron Damon. So we're going to keep looking for Mike. He just celebrated an 85th birthday, and we would love to get him on the show. So if you know Mike or have any dealings with Mike, be sure to drop us a line here at Monster Attack, and who knows, maybe we can get the old Baron on our show sometime down the road. Well, I should add that I was up there for a high school reunion as well as just a vacation, and I was amazed how many kids did remember me as being a monster kid. You know, I've told you on and off how we were sort of unusual back then growing up. I was into all of the monster models, and I hardly ever missed the monster movie matinee or the late night show. And I had not really forgotten, but it had just sort of, you know, passed by me that for a month and a half I had lived with my aunt and cousins. Because my folks were moving to Raleigh, North Carolina, and I had to stay up there to take the state exams, or I would have had to repeat the grade that I was in, and sure didn't want to do that. I just started high school, didn't want to have to repeat that grade all over again because I was getting pretty good grades at the time. So I lived with my aunt and cousins for about a month and a half while I was taking those state exams, and then I joined my folks and my two sisters in Raleigh, North Carolina right after that. But okay, I'm going round and round on this, but what this involves is my cousin, who's my age, we were in the same high school and elementary school class. On Saturday nights, you know, she always wondered what I was going to do. And they had a really nice basement built out into a rec room, really nice rec room down there. And I said, well, I'm going to go downstairs and watch the monster movie. And I got her into monster movies during this time. So I was reminded of the monster movies and the little frozen pizzas that her mom would keep in a big chest-style freezer down there in the rec room. And we would pop that one, you know, two of those into the oven, and that would be our refreshments for the monster movie that was shown at night. Now, I think a couple of those movies were actually out of the Rochester station, which on my TV at my house didn't come in real well because we had a smaller antenna. But my cousin Boo, they had a big antenna, so we were able to get the Rochester station pretty well. And they had like a primetime monster movie on there. It was an independent station, so they could show monster movies on primetime. So we got to see a lot of really, really good films while I was staying with her. And she always talks about that, about the little pizzas and monster movies. And then I had some other friends come up who were listeners, and you guys know who you are, of the podcast, people I'd gone to school with, and telling me, you know, secret, they really did sort of like these movies and the impact that it had on them. So, you know, folks, it's amazing to me how much of a lifestyle watching these old monster movies was. I mean, more and more as I meet people, and even people not my age, younger than me, just how much these films mean to everybody. And that really is what Monster Attack is all about. So before the break, before we went into our two-week break, I had been looking at films that were not only celebrating major anniversaries here, and they're films that we had talked about before, but films from around the mid to late 1950s, because these were some of the greatest monster movies that I saw growing up, and they still hold up after all this time. Some, you know, some folks might think they're a little cheesy, but they meant so much to us when we watched. And I am going to talk about an actor and a film that I can honestly say just absolutely blew my mind when I saw this film for the first time. And in some of my film books, they say, well, this film didn't get a whole lot of airplay on TV. And, you know, so after it did very well in the theaters in 1957, yeah, this is another 1957 film, and probably, in my opinion, the best one that came out during that year. So it's a happy 65th birthday. We're talking about Incredible Shrinking Man. The Incredible Shrinking Man, a brilliant motion picture. And if you've not seen this movie, I know I've said this about a lot of other films, but if you have not seen The Incredible Shrinking Man, the original one with Grant Williams, it is a film you have got to see sometime during your lifetime. In fact, there's a book by Steven Schneider, 1001 Films You Have to See Before You Die. I think that's the title of the book, but whatever, Steven, apologies if I get the title wrong. He's absolutely right. This is one of those films on your list of you know, like an ultimate bucket list. You've got to see this movie at some time in your lifetime. Even today, considering the limited technology they had back there to do the special effects they did, this film is brilliantly done and brilliantly written by Richard Matheson. He had written the story that the script was based on that was changed quite a bit, and we're going to talk about that a little bit because we didn't talk about that much when we were discussing Incredible Shrinking Man a couple of seasons ago. But all the changes that were made on this were really, really very well done. And this film not only was just a magnificent monster movie, for me personally, it really opened up the door for what I would call thought-provoking horror films and monster movies, because this one did something that not too many monster movies had done up until 1957, and that is it didn't really have a set ending. Yeah, and I'm going to just let you sit on that one. Well, those of you that have watched the movie know what I'm talking about. But we're going to come back and revisit what I just said there as we talk about just the incredible parts of The Incredible Shrinking Man. But it didn't really have an ending. And that was something that didn't happen in films in the 1950s very much. Now, it would be something that would be adapted into films in the late 1960s, and most definitely during the golden years of the independent films that came out in the 70s. And like I've kidded with you on many occasions, I think it was against the law for filmmakers in the 1970s to have an ending for their films, because so many of them just ended. But this one does it on a very, very unique note. And it really did open up my eyes to films that made you think. Now, there's monsters in this. There are definitely monsters in this, but it's a very simple story. And I think that's the thing that adds to the beauty of this film, because we're dealing with a situation that is just fantastical in every way, shape, and form. You've got a man who is shrinking, literally shrinking. It does not have a happy Hollywood ending. So, yeah, I'm spoiling it already. For those of you that haven't seen the movie, you know, I could probably spoil this whole movie. And still, when you go and watch it, if you haven't seen it before, you're going to be blown away by how well this film is made. Made by the incredible director of this time period, Jack Arnold, who had, you know, done some of the best movies that I saw growing up, you know, the best monster movies that I ever saw. He became the guy for Universal Studios. You know, Hammer had Terrence Fisher as one of their top directors, but Jack Arnold really owned Universal during this time period. Or I should say, you know, technically Universal International, because they had taken a different direction with their horror, and now the horror became more of more centered around the radioactive stuff. And this film definitely has that component to it as well. In fact, a major, major component to it. But Jack Arnold, just, 87 credits as a director of television and films. But, when you talk about, some of the all-time classic monster movies made, like Creature from the Black Lagoon, he was the best. I mean, he was really the best, and he had quite a challenge ahead of him making a film of this nature. When you think about the effects that they were going to have to use to make this story about a man by the name of Scott Carey, who is literally shrinking, over a period of several months. And this is the thing that I really liked about The Incredible Shrinking Man, because, it could have been very cheesy. And we've seen with apologies to Burt Igord, Burt made Attack of the Puppet People, which was about people who were shrunken down. But compared to this film, it's a little cheesy, but it's still one I love. I still love it. But Matheson, in his screenplay, took a different approach in his story and in screenplay, that he wanted to talk more about the man, more so than just the obvious shrinking issue. And I think that's what really set this film above so many of the others. So he didn't take the easy way out on this, and neither did Jack Arnold. Now, the one major change that they made from Matheson's original story, and he was a little bothered by it, but he came around to understand why they did it, was Matheson's story was basically a flashback, a series of flashbacks, and, told in these little vignettes, which was, a very unique way of telling the story. But when Universal International got the rights to the story, one of the conditions was that Richard Matheson would write the screenplay. And, they directed him. They said, changing up the format a little bit, he didn't really want to change the flashback format, which, for those of you who are familiar with the story, puts Scott in the basement. And as we will be going on, for those of you that haven't seen the movie, and you might want to wait to listen to the rest of this podcast until after you've seen the movie, because this is going to spoil everything. But when Scott makes it into the basement, that's like the last quarter of the film, because he is about the size of a small insect at this point. And then we have some major, major scenes with one of the scariest monsters I've ever seen in any motion picture. More to come on that one. But Richard Alan Simmons was brought in by Universal to just change up the order. I mean, he didn't really rewrite the script. They just moved things around so it was more told in a more linear way. And I think it played very well on screen, and I think it was probably the right choice. Many times I'm sort of opposed to changing a writer's work. It's like, who are we to, change his work? But in this case, I think it really made it a better film on screen. Now, I think reading the story, I think the series of flashbacks where, it isn't in a linear method where you're flashing back to how he got, shrunk down to that size, plays probably pretty well. But anyway, be that as it may, that was the only major change made to this. And the ending of this, Universal had done some test screenings of the film, and the audiences wanted a better ending. They didn't like the ending. Like I said, it really wasn't an ending. And, I think everybody had been conditioned for what we call your stereotypical happy Hollywood ending or whatever. And monster movies and sci-fis usually had that. But here you got a film that doesn't. And you got a film that's very engaging. And you've got Scott, who's masterfully played by Grant Williams. And we're going to talk about Grant again in a minute. One of our favorites here on Monster Attack. Very, very underrated actor, in my opinion. But you got this guy who's a very likable character, and you're pulling for him throughout the movie. And, of course, Jack Arnold is great at establishing that in films and really drawing people in. So you get really attached to these people, almost like family. And then the movie just ends. And you want to know what happens to him. I'm going to spend some more time on that in just a second here. So we're going to just set the table for the movie itself and some of the things that just really were my favorite parts of this film. Now, the one thing I do want to mention again is the radioactive part of the story. And, you know, as I've said over and over again, and I hope you don't get tired of me mentioning this, but so many films from this time period were, you know, incorporating the fear that we had about this power that we call nuclear power, and not knowing much about it and sort of conjecturing as to what the bad effects of it are. I mean, we saw that in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but there was even more that we did not understand about it that made it deadly serious. You know, even though scientists were trying to find positive uses for nuclear reactors, as a way of generating energy and that sort of thing. But there's a lot of downside to it as well. We're not going to get into that here. But so the fear was there. Right? We talked a few weeks ago about people looking to buy bomb shelters and that sort of thing. It was a scary, scary time. This movie treats it very subtly. And that was one thing that I think as a kid, the first time, really thinking back to the first time I saw this movie, I saw it by myself. My sister wasn't with me on this one. I was in the living room of my house in Auburn, New York, and it was on Monster Movie Matinee. And, one thought that went through my mind when I was doing some research this week for this rendition of Incredible Shrinking Man was, the mention that this movie did not get many showings on television. And I kept thinking, thank God for the Monster Movie Matinees of the country, because they were the ones showing it, because they got these packages from Universal. And so they were showing it. But, the regular networks were not showing this movie. So there were a lot of people that didn't see it. If you didn't watch Monster Movie Matinee or Chiller Theater or, all of those, you didn't see this movie. And it didn't get re-released in the theaters much. You got one re-release a few years after it first came out. But for the most part, it was a film that you didn't get an opportunity to watch a whole lot until DVDs came out. Or, well, I should say VHS. Probably VHS. We'll go not quite as far as DVDs. But we're talking mid-80s there. But the Monster Kids, who planted themselves in front of the TV on Saturday to watch the weekend offering of Monster Movie Matinee, they got to see this movie quite a few times. Four that I can recall, over the period of my elementary school years and some of my high school years, I probably saw this film four or five times. And it was one of those films that when VHSs, started becoming very, very prevalent, and I got my first VCR and stuff. This is like one of the first films I got because I wanted to, I wanted to be able to watch it anytime I could. And again, folks, and this is no exaggeration, this film is as powerful and as entertaining today as it was when I first saw it as a kid. Oh, the impression this film left on me as a kid was just unbelievable because it was so different from the films I saw. I saw films about, people running away from giant monsters and things like that. You've got your giant behemoths and Godzilla and all of those. But this was different. And the radioactive element involved in this was there, but not over the top. Because we start out on the water, and Scott and his wife, Louise, played by Randy Stewart, we'll talk about Randy here in a little bit, they're out on the boat, they're sort of sunbathing, just relaxing, and Scott tells Louise, I really would like to get a beer, and a little playful back and forth with husband and wife with her, well, you can get up and get it, and he says, oh, no, and she ends up going to get it, and because of that, she is in the boat, inside the boat, when this fog bank, that's the only way you can describe it. It's just this big mist, a big fog bank, sort of floating closer and closer. And the buildup to this is done so well by Jack Arnold. Because you got Scott standing there out there on the prow of the boat, looking at this thing just slowly coming to him. And he's not sure what to think about it. And it's basically, fog. That's what it looks like. And it comes and covers him up. And then, it passes on. And then Louise comes on and says, what in the world? What was that? And he's got, he's got these droplets of water or something on him. And he's a little shook up like it because it was so bizarre. But he just sort of was frozen there for a minute and just, allowed it to engulf him and then move on. And it just moves on, down the water. They don't think anything of it. They dry him off and all that. And then, very subtly, the story starts with Scott shrinking. And it's little things. like, you know, he gets his clothes from the cleaner, but something's wrong. He says, I think I got the wrong clothes. I think they gave me the wrong ones because the shirt's a little too big. You know, the sleeve comes down to his hand. It doesn't fit properly. The pants are too big. Maybe he's losing weight or whatever. And then he finds out he is losing weight. And so all of this leads up to him going to the doctor because all of a sudden his clothes are like fitting terribly on him. And the doctor confirms he's losing weight and he's also losing height. And he can't figure it out because he says, people don't do that. And, you know, I won't go into all the details of all the doctor visits, but slowly Scott is shrinking. And they have no explanation for it. And they're with the doctor, played capably by William Shallert, again, another favorite of ours from the father from the Patty Duke show and Them. And oh my God, he made a regular appearance on Wild Wild West. Every time we turned around, we saw William Shallert in a lot of things. And I loved him in the movie Matinee, where he played a doctor in that, sort of spoofing his character here in The Incredible Shrinking Man. It was really, really good. William Shallert is just one of those guys that we all loved watching growing up in monster movies and science fictions. And he was also the last surviving member of this cast. When William passed away in 2018, he was the last member of the cast that was still around from this film. So a lot of the folks in this film died in their 60s, died early on. But you've got this situation where they're trying to figure out what's going on, and the doctor mentions, you know, have you been exposed to any kind of chemicals or anything like that? Is that something unusual happening? And then he remembers that they were spraying for mosquitoes. Now, they used to do this in my neighborhood as well. I know in Raleigh, I can't remember if they did it in Auburn or not. We used to get gnats really bad, as I found out during my vacation. Oh, I got eaten alive, I'll tell you what, folks. But they used to spray in Raleigh for mosquitoes because the mosquitoes were, you know, the humidity was so high. They're really, really bad down there. And he says, well, yeah, I was exposed to that. And then they think about, oh, the fog. And now they're sort of surmising that the toxin from the blood test, he had exposed to some kind of chemical, some kind of toxin that seems to be causing this reaction. And apparently it was like the perfect storm scenario. He's exposed to something with this fog, but then it was the insecticide that set it off and got it going. But they still don't know what it is, but they know what it's doing. And there's just a hint that maybe it was some kind of radioactive element, you know, something that's why it's so unknown. But it's not right out there in your face. And that was something that I think made it even more frightening to me, especially when I watched it for the first time, because everything that I'd seen in this could have happened. The exposure to some kind of strange chemical or this weird, bizarre bank of fog and whatever. I mean, this is all, I grew up on a lake, spent a lot of time out on a boat. And my uncle had this wonderful boat. And we'd go out all that time. It took me a while to learn how to swim and water ski, but I mean, I spent a lot of time in water. And this, you know, when I was up there for vacation, just, you know, these past couple of weeks, you'd wake up in the morning and you could look across the lake and you'd see the big fog bank, you know, as the temperatures were changing. And it got me thinking about this movie and it got me thinking, this is, I want to talk about this film again. So, I mean, these were the things that, and I'm sure Jack Arnold kept that in mind, that these, you know, these are familiar things that could happen. So you don't really have to extend, you know, stretch your disbelief or whatever on this because, well, the shrinking part, yes, but that's the fantastical part of the movie. So we know that's coming. That's the given. And Scott just keeps getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And we're introduced to two very, very popular actors. Well, one, she had a short career, actress by the name of April Kent. She was 63 when she passed away, but She only performed in six projects, the last one being a television series, The Men of Annapolis. But she was in Tammy and the Bachelor and The Incredible Shrinking Man and Rock Pretty Baby, probably her three most popular films that people would remember her from. She was in a film I've Lived Before about reincarnation, which was sort of cool, I remember. But a very, very pretty gal, and a small gal. Because she's playing a little person in this. Because now Scott has come to the point where he is about the size of a little person, you know, like maybe 4 foot tall or less. and he meets April Kent's character, Clarice, who is involved with a circus that's in town. And then we also meet a little guy that was one of my favorites also growing up, and that's Billy Curtis. And, of course, Billy Curtis is a legendary little person from Hollywood. He poo-pooed going into, like, carnival sideshows and that sort of thing growing up, which a lot of little people were forced to do because they couldn't get jobs anywhere. And he said, no, I'm going to, you know, I'm just going to go. He was a shoe clerk. He just went doing mainstream jobs, but soon he took on a little person role in a stage production, and you know, and he sort of fell in love, you know, like we all do, those of us who act. He fell in love with acting, and was able to get a film contract. And his first big movie was in 1939 in The Wizard of Oz, playing one of the Munchkins. In fact, Judy Garland said he made a lot of passes at her during the movie. But I remember him playing a character, a Martian, in The Adventures of Superman. He was in Clint Eastwood's High Plains Drifter, if you remember that. He played a great character in that. It was also in the little crime caper, one of the last films he made, Little Cigars. All of that, starting with The Wizard of Oz. But he was a very, very active actor. And he also played, for those of you, eagle-eyed from the 60s and 70s and 80s, actually. He played Mayor McCheese, was played by Billy Curtis, right up until the time of his death in 1988. And McDonald's thought so much of him that they retired the character after Billy died in 1988. He was just an incredible man. He also appeared in The Thing from Another World. And someone would say, Jim, what are you talking about? There was no little people in that. Well, they needed a smaller version of The Thing, and that was Billy Curtis. He played a smaller version of The Thing, you know, replacing James Arness, because, you know, James was huge. I mean, big guy. So, yeah, even Billy had an uncredited role in that film as well. So the one thing that I really like about this film is how they dig into the effect the shrinking is having on him. He didn't ask for this. You know, it becomes very, you know, become publicly known. So they've got paparazzi all over the place and camera people and stuff waiting for him to, you know, so he felt like he was in prison. It's causing a horrible strain on his marriage to Louise. And again, Randy Stewart, a very, very veteran actress of screen and TV series, a lot of TV. I mean, if you were alive in the 60s, you probably saw her on every Western that they had on television. She made appearances and some regular appearances on them, as many of them did. And she also had a chance to cross paths with Grant Williams on Hawaiian Eye. So those two knew each other, you know, from they had known each other from Incredible Shrinking Man, and then appeared, you know, cross paths on Hawaiian Eye later on. So and that's what a lot of people remember Grant Williams for that TV show with Connie Stevens. But I will always remember Grant Williams for this movie and Monolith Monsters. In fact, Monolith was the first one that I ever saw him in. And it was like, yeah, I like this guy. He's good. He's really good. I think he's just such an understated character actor. So you've got some veteran people in this. And, you know, originally Grant was not the first choice to play Scott Carey. That went to Dan O'Herlihy. And again, another favorite of mine. I've always, always liked Dan O'Herlihy. We're going to be doing an old film of his very, very soon here on Monster Attack. So I'll give him a quick plug. But he read the script and he was afraid he might get typecast because he had just finished doing Robinson Crusoe. And said, nah, I'm going to pass on that. And then the people looked at Grant Williams. And, you know, Grant was doing Monolith Monsters and stuff. These films were shot very close to one another. And they said, yeah, this guy will work. Let's use him. And I really can't see anybody else in this film because he plays the range of emotions so well. He's not really like over the top all the time. Like some actors nowadays feel like, you know, if you're frustrated, everything has to be over the top. It was a burning rage. And we could see it develop between he and Louise, and then he's being torn by the fact that he's doing this to his wife, and it's not really her fault either, and the pressures that are going on with all this going on, and he just sneaks out one night And that's where he meets April Kent's character, Clarice, and also meets Billy Curtis's character as well. And they and he and Clarice develop a relationship. They become very close because she understands the problems of being a little person in a big world. And they become very, very close. And so now you see this take a very strange direction where Louise is very, very loyal to Scott, and she's going to stick by him through all of this. But I think she's even aware of the fact that this is going on to the extent it is. Now, in the book, in the story, they actually have a love relationship. They have a very intimate relationship in the book. Universal thought that was just a little too risque for a monster movie in 1957, and probably they were right on that. I think it would have been hard for parents to let their kids see this with that element in there. So they took that out. There were some other elements in the story that were pretty risque as well that were taken out. And those were changes, I think, that needed to be made. And Matheson made those changes in the screenplay. But there's a wonderful scene where Scott and Clarice are talking on a park bench. And they both get up to go home. And all of a sudden, Scott just stops. And Clarice is like, "What's wrong?" And he realizes that he is shorter than she is. Now, they had kidded earlier in the movie that he was a little taller than her. And one of the ways she sort of broke through to him and said, "See, it's not so bad. There's someone that's actually shorter than you." But now he realizes he's starting to shrink again because they had discovered something they thought might have stopped the shrinking process. But apparently now it's started right back again. And he's crushed. And then the story takes a quick jump, and we see Scott now living in a house that looks, the interior of the house looks different. Maybe they moved or whatever, and then we find out. And this is done so well. I mean, it just really smacks in the face. He's living in a dollhouse. It's a dollhouse like my sister's had. You know, it's open, you know, on one side, so that you can put in the little, you know, the little doll people and the furniture and all that stuff. Then you can push it up against the wall. It's pushed up against the wall, and he's living in there now. Now, we know that the Carries had a cat, you know, and now we're coming into place like, oh, my God, you know, they have to keep the cat outside because if he's, you know, if the cat's allowed inside with Scott there, that's pretty dangerous stuff. You know, again, because now Scott is no longer the owner of the cat. He's prey. Because he's the size of, you know, about the size of a small mouse. And Louise has to leave for a little while. And you know, through a series of unfortunate circumstances, the cat sneaks in. And then it is one of the most intense scenes you're going to see in this movie. Where the cat, you know, realizes he's there and going after him like it would a mouse. And, I mean, it is intense. I mean, the cat does manage to injure him. Catches him with a claw, you know, across his back, and he's able to get away by pulling on a power cord attached to a lamp, and the lamp falls down, hits the cat, and the cat runs away. But as Scott's trying to get away, he's heading for the basement. I mean, he's desperate. He doesn't know how, you know, where he can go to get away from this cat, and he figures maybe the basement would be a good place. And while the cat's trying to get at him, it comes back and tries to get at him in the basement. It ends up, he's trying to close the basement door. And of course, you know, he's tiny. I mean, this door is heavy. And the cat ends up busting open the door and he goes flying down into a big box. Fortunately, with a lot of soft stuff in it, like, you know, paper and stuff. That's what it breaks his fall. And this puts him in the basement. And now it's a whole different movie because he's continually getting smaller and he's about the size of a small insect. At this point, and we it's almost like a survival type thing. What can you find? What normal items can you find in a basement that you can live on? You got to find water. You've got to find food. You've got to find shelter. And he manages to do all that. But we're studying the workings of Scott Carey, and he's changing emotionally and mentally. You know, he finds an old piece of cake that we had seen established earlier in the film. We didn't pay any attention to it, but now it's there. Now this is a source of food for him. He first tries to get a piece of cheese off of a mousetrap, but loses it trying to get the cheese without getting killed by the mousetrap. And then we find out he's not alone in the basement. And this is the part of the film that I think for kids, at least for me, it's the scariest thing in the movie because it's a spider. And you know, a lot of us kids were scared of spiders. I was scared of spiders. And oh, my God. Now, in the story, it was supposed to be a Black Widow spider. And Universal was going to try to keep it that way. Jack Arnold really was going to give it a shot and make it a Black Widow spider, because that had some interesting qualities to it. But in the end, they couldn't go with it. Arnold said it just was too small. We just couldn't make it work. We couldn't make it look right. So they went back to his tried and true spider, Tarantulas. I figured, well, gee, I don't know. Do they have Tarantulas out there? And it's, well, from his perspective, that's probably what it would look like. So, but all I know is it made me terrified. The thought of being the size that he is and going up against this tarantula was one of the most frightening things in the world. And the setup to taking on this guy is just, it's just magnificent. That's worth watching. That and the cat scene are worth watching. And of course, he does prevail, but almost loses it. And I got to tell you, folks, the camera work that Jack Arnold does on this movie blows away the camera work he did on Tarantula. And nothing against Tarantula. It's one of my favorite horror films. And it was made right around this time as well. But he's got some shots, a perspective of looking up underneath when this spider covers up Scott and is going in for the kill. And Scott, what he's got is a big pin that he's using as a big lance. That's his weapon. And, shoves it up there to kill the spider. It's still hard for me to watch. It's just so scary. But that is the climax of this film, because now Scott has killed his enemy. He has saved his food source. Earlier, when he first gets into the basement and he goes up to one of the windows, or actually it's a screen, a little screen, like a little vent in the basement. And that's keeping him from going outside, because he was going to try to do that because of better luck getting food and that sort of thing. Now he's so small he can go through the screen. And this is the ending that some of the test screeners, or I should say the test audiences, didn't like. They wanted changed. A lot of them thought that Jack Arnold should have come up with a way to make him grow back to his normal size, because that would have been a typical Hollywood ending. You know, back to the way you were. Cyclical. Everybody lives happily ever after. It would have ruined this movie. It would have ruined the movie. And I got thinking about this, especially this last time I watched it. Scott Carey had changed considerably. His wife, Louise, had changed considerably. And even if they could have made him the right size, I think the emotional damage that had been done from the stress that they felt from all of the press and all of that would have been too much. I don't think they would have ever been able to recover from that. So I think Matheson was right in saying, no, we're going to keep the original ending. Because the original ending has him walking outside. He gets through, walks through this screen. He's that small now. And Matheson specifically wrote a closing narration for Grant Williams. And it's brilliant. Talking about infinity and the universe and the infinite nature of the universe. And just trying to imagine. And almost teasing you, like, will he get as small as an atom? Is that possible? You know, how much smaller can he get? Or what will happen? And leaving it to the audience. And I think that's what makes this film so powerful. It's because it's one of those films. And I love films like this, where if you see it, then you can get with a bunch of people who have also seen it, and you can discuss that issue. Well, yeah, really, what happens? You know, how small can he get? And I've talked about this a few times with friends of mine who were monster kids. Makes this film very, very strong. So I wanted to revisit it and visit some of the other incredible issues of this movie, because I still think this is one of the best sci-fi. I call it a sci-fi, call it a monster movie. It's got elements of both. But from 1957, I think this was the number one. It was one of the top grossing science fiction films of the 1950s. You know, that puts it in a league with Journey to the Center of the Earth and others like that. So The Incredible Shrinking Man, folks, from 1957, starring, again, I think one of the most underrated actors we've ever seen in monster movies and sci-fis and other movies, Grant Williams. Perfect casting, even though he won the first choice, it ended up being the perfect casting choice. And he plays this brilliantly, and he should have won some awards for this film. I really do believe he should have, because it's just, he had to play so much of this without even seeing anybody. Like the basement scenes alone, he's playing it in front of a black screen. So if you've not seen Incredible Shrinking Man, you got to see it. It's a film you've just got to see, folks. Folks, we will be back with you again next Monday with an all-new episode of Monster Attack. Talked with Mark not too long ago. Mark's going to be joining us very soon, maybe even next week. I'll just keep you I'll just tease you on that one. I'm not sure if we're going to be able to get Mark for next week or the week after that, but he is going to be joining us. So look forward to that. We've got a really good film coming your way when Mark gets together with me. So, folks, have a great week, and we will see you next Monday.
Coming this summer to a podcast near you, be prepared for the return of...
The Jedi.
No, the return of...
The King.
No, the return of...
Swamp Thing?
You are such an idiot. The return of...
Oh, the Monster Sci-Fi Show.
Yes, it's coming back and it's about time.
The Monster Sci-Fi Show is part of the Rebel Alliance, part of your complete breakfast, and part of the ESO Network. It's sci-fi from a certain point of view.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.